Period on the exact wording of that. And he was recently honored by the Penn Relays as the 2012 recipient of the Jesse Abramson Award given to an active member of the media with a particular devotion to the Penn Relays. How many Penn folks do we have here? All right, so the Penn Relays, we love it. Bill Cosby, the whole thing. To Donald's right, we have Leo Landino, and Leo is a Venezuelan journalist who has covered baseball in Latin America and the United States since 1996 as a commentator, producer, and writer for many print and electronic publications. He has worked for Aguilas del Zulia of the Venezuelan League and the Tampa Bay Rays. He currently produces all baseball properties for ESPN Deportes in the Spanish language and contributes to ESPNDeportes.com. Landino has done extensive research with Sabre on the life of Luis Castro. And then to Leo's right there, we have Paul Hagen. Paul began his career in 1974 covering the Dodgers in San Bernardino, California, before covering the Texas Rangers in Dallas-Fort Worth for 10 years. And I believe you were there for the Lenny Randle years, is that correct? Yes, I thought so. He then worked for 25 years covering the Phillies for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he now works for MLB.com as a national reporter focusing on the Phillies. He was the winner of this year's Spink Award for baseball writing, and Paul has the distinction of being the only recent honoree at the Hall of Fame induction to actually be alive. Which, by the way, for someone who has worked for Philadelphia newspapers for 25 years is quite a trick. And then on the right, last but certainly not least, is Jason Stark. And a little editorializing here. Personally, I consider Jason one of the most important baseball writers of the past 50 years because his work has always had the most contagious smile in the business. With ESPN since 2000, Jason, of course, first emerged on the national scene at the Philadelphia Inquirer with his Week in Review page, which was required reading for me at Penn in the late 1980s, where he treated us to crazy coincidences, silly statistics, and the simple joy of baseball's unpredictability. And it lives on today in his pathological, useless information department. Here in Philadelphia, Bill Conlon and Paul have been planted in Cooperstown, and Jason shouldn't be far behind. So I want to thank all these guys. I'm not sure anyone realizes how hard all of these folks work around the trading deadline for their being here today is really quite a testament to their character and, frankly, their love for what you guys do. So I know we're here to perhaps focus a little bit on the challenges that writers and broadcasters face in the 24/7 pace of modern sports reporting, but we have a few things to dispatch with today. Now, forgive me because I'm not in baseball anymore, and after 5 years of covering football's head injury problem, I have journalistic post-concussion syndrome. But I believe we just did pass the trading deadline, and unless I missed anything, okay, I think I traded more germs at Starbucks this morning than teams did before 4 p.m. on July 31st. Guys, what happened to the old days when Mark McGwire, Fred McGriff, Randy Johnson, David Cone, and of course Heathcliff Slocum? You know, those guys were transforming pennant races on July 31st, and this year, basically nothing. Paul, explain.
Explain this, Paul.
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably three factors that have gone into this. One is the extra wild card, so more teams, you know, feel like they're in contention. Secondly, there's less need for teams to make trades for financial reasons because each team got $25 million extra dollars this year with the national TV contract. And thirdly, I think if you look around, teams are signing up their best young players to long-term contracts to keep them out of free agency. A lot of these guys that were traded at the deadline were pending free agents. Teams didn't think they could re-sign them. A lot of those guys are already re-signed, so there's no real need to trade them. So those would be the three things I would think of.
Jason, was there anything that you saw this year that was particularly distinctive rather than that just general trend that we've been watching over the past 5 to 8 years?
Well, I had somebody stop me at the All-Star game and said, here's a story that you need to write. There are no players anymore. Now, obviously, we know that there are many players, right? But what he meant was, there are no players available anymore. There's so much money in the game. And, you know, I'm sure our dads all told us, follow the money. Well, if you follow the money in baseball, there's a lot of it. It's an $8 billion industry. And, you know, a half billion dollars in revenue sharing money changes hands every year, correct? And so the trading deadline for a long time was a money dump fest. And now it's not. Now there are, if you go back and look at this trading deadline, there were virtually no classic money dumps. And that makes it very difficult to make a deal. The other thing that used to generate a lot of activity was if you had a player who was going to be a free agent and you traded him, that the team that traded for him was going to get a draft pick or draft picks on the other end, and it was worth the risk. Now there's no draft pick compensation attached, and so the value of the rental player is less. You combine all that with all those forces that Paul was talking about, and there was not a lot of impetus for teams to make trades. And so, you know, as somebody who is basically sentenced to trade deadline coverage from the second that the All-Star game ends, you know, I devote every waking second to covering the trade deadline, and sadly, many non-waking seconds where I find myself rolling around in bed wondering where Alex Rios could possibly wind up. It's not healthy. But I got to the day of the trading deadline, and I started calling around because, I mean, Jake Peavy had just been traded, and we're preparing for this big day where we've got an hour special on ESPN, and every team I was checking with said, we've got nothing. And I finally asked one guy who's been an executive in the game for a long, long time, and I said, who's the best player who's going to be traded today? And he literally did not speak for 20 seconds, and then he said, I think I just answered your question. So it was that kind of year.
And you know what's weird is Jason, from what I understand, it's no easier to cover a trading deadline period when there's nobody being traded. Is it even harder?
Well, you mean for us?
Yeah, for you guys.
It's much harder. It's much easier when something actually happens. It's kind of like a fundamental principle of modern journalism. And when nothing's happening, it creates a lot of noise, and never more in the world we live in now. It's in a 24/7 world where all of us operate with no deadlines, and round the clock means to just spread whatever we hear. And Twitter and social media, a lot of noise gets spewed into the ozone, and it's very difficult to resist the temptation now to just throw stuff out there. But, I mean, if I don't know how many of you are on Twitter. I mean, you'll see people on Twitter who will actually have to say, I retract my previous tweet because they threw something out there, and it turned out to be completely wrong. And that's my goal every trading deadline is never to tweet, I retract my previous tweet.
Can you retract a tweet now?
Can you retract? You can delete a tweet.
You can delete it? Oh, crap. I got to go.
Right. The problem is, even if you delete it, it's already too late. A lot of public figures have discovered that, Alan.
Yeah, that's true. We have a congressman in our midst, I'll have you know. Does he want to admit that? No, he doesn't want to admit he's here. It's true. You know what's really fun is I don't know if you guys realize how rare it is to hear the media talk about the media. Sorry. Yeah. Now, Don and Leo, your audiences perhaps are slightly different. I don't want to overestimate how different they really are, but can you tell us what goes into covering a baseball season for you guys that perhaps is different, from what these guys, in terms of having to deal with 99% of the baseball reading public, you guys have a bit of a special niche. Don, can you tell me a little bit, how do you approach covering baseball news for your paper?
Yes, well, the Tribune is African-American newspaper, you know, we're the oldest newspaper, African-American newspaper here in Philly. And what we try to do, we try to highlight a lot of the African-American players in Major League Baseball. But we also try to understand that We cover baseball, you know, across the board. We give them that view as well. We also try to stay on top of some of the rising African-American stars that come into the game, and not only in Major League Baseball, but also in the minors, also in HBCU baseball. So we try to give our readers and people that pick up the Tribune for the first time something different that they don't normally get in some of the other publications around the country or on the web or in Twitter world or something like that. So it gets hectic, but there's always another story to write, and it's really good stuff out there.
Leo, I just want to interrupt before you go, just with Don. I'm now remembering as we sit up here. In 1996, there was a story done. Paul, I don't think you wrote it, but I think it was a column in the Daily News. In 1996, it was noticed that the Phillies did not have one African-American player on the entire roster, on 25-man roster. And I remember as a math geek, I wanted to see what were the chances of there being any major league team or having all major league teams have at least one, given that I think the percentage of African-American players at that time was about 9%. And of course, I figured out all the numbers, and it was extraordinarily likely that one team was going to have none. But nonetheless, do you remember that period that preceded the Marlon Anderson, Doug Glanville, Ryan Howard era, where you guys actually were about the most African-American team in the league? What was it like when that story appeared, and then about the 7 years that transformed the team? And do you think that was intentional on the Phillies' part?
Well, you know, there's this underlying feeling in the African-American community, not by everybody, but with the Phillies being the last team, one of the last few teams to have African-American players, there's always been a feeling that they haven't really reached out and been active in terms of drafting, in terms of trading, in terms of acquiring players. But I think you see now, like, Jimmy Rollins and Ron Howard, to me, are still like the face of the Phillies organization. And back in 96, where they didn't have any, it was difficult, and it was something a lot of people were aware of, particularly a lot of baseball fans in this town. So it's something that had to be brought to light. And obviously, there's great players out there, and I think at that time there was a lot of talk about not playing a lot of baseball in our community, into the African American community, into the inner city, and that sort of thing. But it's just good to see it evolve a little bit now. I mean, I still think, with the lack of blacks playing baseball, it still needs to get better, in terms of participation and that sort of thing. But it'd be nice to see it evolve, and that was a big story, and that was a big time during that coverage.
But Leo, getting back to what we were talking about before, with ESPN Deportes, how do you guys handle the complete, absence of Latin American players in baseball these days? I mean, you're desperate, man.
Well,
speak.
The pretty much the basis of what we do, of how baseball is covered in Spanish. First of all, it's not different than in English. I mean, we still cover every aspect of the game, but the difference will be, the main difference is the basis that, or the notion that that baseball teams are not anymore a neighborhood team. They're like, the Phillies are not anymore like the Phillies, like the team of Philadelphia. Like, Major League Baseball teams are world-class sports organizations with tons of money in the mix. So whatever decision makes a baseball team in the office, in the field, may impact fans around the world, especially in Latin America. So because it's the biggest baseball market after the United States, even bigger than Japan, probably. So so we pretty much cover the personal stories of players, how they get here, the struggles they still need to pass through to get into the majors, to establish themselves, about the baseball elite. So each team becomes like, you know, we have like, we have there are countries maybe like in Venezuela, for example, that maybe the Detroit Tigers, they have a lot of fans now, younger fans now, because they have guys like Miguel Cabrera doing pretty good in Detroit, so they, that draws a lot of fans from Venezuela. Or the Yankees, historically, they have a lot of fan base across the Latin countries because it's the Yankees. Or the thing is that teams are not small, and we know that, and the way to cover it is to share the stories and to tell them to tell our audience, hey, these guys are not just playing here and making millions of dollars. These guys are here, you know, trying to make a living, trying to, you know, find a better way to overcome poverty in most of the places, in most of the cases, like coming out of the Dominican Republic, coming out of Venezuela. So those stories are pretty much highlighted all over the season, and you know, their success stories are inspiring for fans across the world.
Now, I've been attending, and I know Jason, even you more so, the rookie career development programs. I went several years. I think Jason, you've been a speaker there, or I'm not sure if you've been doing it
probably
lately.
Probably a half dozen years, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jason is often there to help talk to rookies about what the press is like, how to deal with the press. And, of course, they brought in the nicest member of the press. So it wasn't exactly a fair representation of us. I think that Latin Americans' experience here in the United States has been helped by a lot of the team efforts to educate players. You know, gone are the days when Pedro Martinez had to learn English with Guy Conti in the back of the Great Falls bus in 1990 or whatever it was. You know, one thing I did want to ask you, Leo, is obviously there's a lot of talk, I'm not sure if you've heard, about steroids and performance-enhancing drugs and whatnot. But, you know, with all the focus on Ryan Braun and Alex Rodriguez and whatnot, I think I was talking to a New York Times editor yesterday. I'm making up this number, but I don't think it's far off. Among the minor league suspensions since the program began, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, it's got to be at least 70% of the players ensnared in the minor league suspensions have been Latin American, okay? Have been from countries where, you know, English is not spoken or whatever. How, as a Latin American yourself, and given your audience, how do you cover that? They appear to have broken the rules, but something's going on where the vast majority of guys, they're the ones getting caught.
Well, at the beginning, it's like, well, we have a very good reference. Well, like, we have Ozzie Guillen working for us and ESPN Deportes. So, like Ozzie says, it's like at the beginning, we used to treat them like, oh, it's naive. It's like these guys don't know what are they doing, because all the instructions are in English and they can't speak English. At the beginning, that was a thought, but not anymore. I mean, right now, they're stupid. They're simply stupid. Now, because they're going to get caught.
Can I tweet that?
Yeah. Because they're going to get caught. I mean, yes, of course, it's easier to get illegal steroids in countries like Dominican Republic, Mexico, Venezuela. Yes, it's easier because laws aren't as strict as in the United States, and they know it. But they know that eventually they're gonna get caught, and that's what like younger players, especially in the development stages, like in rookie ball, in the summer leagues in Venezuela, Dominican Republic, sometimes even before they sign, when these are 16-year-old kids who have trainers who are gonna get a pay cut from their bonuses. So these guys are like, hey, you know, if you get this, you probably hit better or you can train harder, and you're gonna get a bigger bonus, and my pocket is gonna be fuller. So, and you know, if you need the money, why not go? And you know, if you get caught, you got caught after you got the money, but you still keep the money. So it's baseball is a business, and all of these decision making process for, like Jason was saying, for since the offices and the players are based in money right now, and what current players and what people around baseball are trying to tell younger kids, especially in Latin America, is that if you do it, you're gonna get caught because Major League Baseball is becoming stricter, and they're gonna get into the bottom of this.
Do you think that they are gonna get caught in terms of the number? You know, what percentage of guys actually get caught? Okay, I mean, just because 70% of the guys who get caught are, and that, I'm making up that number, right. But I really don't think it's right. far off. You know, how good is the testing program? You know, is it really going to catch all
who
do?
I think it's better than it was 15 years ago. It's making progress. It's progressing. I mean, we can obviously it's not perfect, but I think they've taken the right steps to cut more guys and at least to spread the awareness of, hey, don't do it because it's wrong. I mean, I remember that when I started covering baseball, it was widely known that guys like Sammy Sosa and McGuire were doing steroids, but you know, nobody cared. Yeah, yeah, they were hitting home runs. Who doesn't love a home run? Like everybody.
Chicks dig them, right?
Oh yeah.
Not that any of us here would know that. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, Jason, I'm reminded. I was the editor for Jason and Paul. At Baseball America for a while, which makes it even the more remarkable that they showed up today.
True.
But Jason, I remember talking with you. I was there from 91 to 96, so I was there right for the strike in 94, 95. And we tried to put out a baseball magazine every 2 weeks when nothing was happening. But Jason, I remember talking with you about your covering the strike for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And you made a really good point in saying that the people covering the strike were baseball writers, and in fact, what they should have been were labor reporters. I don't know if you remember that.
Of course I remember it. I'm not in this to cover labor law. It was not what I dreamed of doing when I grew up. I'm sure Paul can relate to this. And you know, it's incredible now that the people you find yourself talking to in our business and the kinds of stories that we wind up covering. I mean, it seems like every few weeks I have to say to somebody, I forgot to graduate from law school this week, or I forgot to go to medical school. Medical school is a big one. Yeah. And then there was labor law. I mean, I was calling the ACLU. I was talking to the dean of the law school at Harvard during that period. It was crazy. What was I doing? You know, I was just trying to follow my reportorial instincts and cover it as best I could. But, I mean, what you see now is how the media world has changed. I mean, if you're following biogenesis, it's probably hard to escape, right? You'll notice that, all right, people like me have to cover it, but we have at ESPN now an entire investigative team, you know, TJ Quinn being the most prominent guy, who covers stories like that full time. Because what used to happen before that was, all right, some big PED revelation would break, and we were, you know, I'd be in spring training and on my way to Fort Myers, and I'd get a call that says, You need to go to Tampa immediately and get reaction to Jason Giambi to this. And so I'd turn the car around and drive for 2 hours and pull into Yankees camp and wait till Jason Giambi got finished working out that day. And then he'd say, I'm not going to comment on that. That is not the way to cover these stories. So we're finally catching on, Alan.
Yeah. Paul, how much do you enjoy covering? Actually, no, this just came to mind. Paul works for MLB.com, which, of course, is Major League Baseball's website. And so, Paul, let's just say you're in the Phillies clubhouse, okay? And you just happen upon Jimmy Rollins sticking a needle in his ass.
That would be a bad image.
Yeah. Nonetheless. Okay, but We all, since the beginning of MLB.com, I was even around during Major League Baseball.com before they bought out Morgan Lewis and Bacchius for the URL. It's true. It's one thing if the New York Times or whatever, ESPN, sees wrongdoing by a player. But everybody has always had the suspicion that if MLB.com comes across something that makes baseball look bad, are they under any special instructions on how to handle it? Paul, have you ever found yourself in a different type of position than you would have at a more independent, if you will, journalistic operation?
Well, I haven't seen anything in a handbook or anything that tells me how to handle that. I think we are going to try to be right. And if I see it, I'd like to think I'd be able to write it. I'm sure it would have to be approved, but I think that's true at all journalistic enterprises. There's editors everywhere. The writers don't just get to go out and throw things out there without running it by their editors, particularly something like that.
You'd be surprised.
But I'll give you an example. It's not quite the same thing, but Todd Zlocki was standing outside Charlie Manuel's office a couple weeks ago before a Sunday game, and Cliff Lee had his wrist slapped for messing around with Jonathan Pettibone during an in-game interview. He was the only writer standing there, and Cliff Lee came up the tunnel, and he was mad because he had had his wrist slapped. Todd was the only one who had it, and he wrote it. And I'm sure that's not the kind of story that the Phillies particularly liked having out there, but he wrote it, we ran it. I'm not saying we certainly don't devote the resources to uncovering things like ESPN does, like the New York papers seem to be doing. But I don't know very many other papers that are either. I don't think we shy away from things, but I think the only thing I've been told in a case like this is write it straight down the middle. They don't want editorializing, and that's okay too. They just want the story straight down the middle. Here's what happened. I don't use a lot of adjectives.
I remember.
Well, I used to. I used to like adjectives.
You were a semicolon guy, were you not? Anyway, I think we've all seen at the bottom of the MLB.com things, this is not subject to the approval of the commissioner of the National Football League or, whatever the hell. And but in all seriousness, I think they've done a great job. I think Major League Baseball, MLB.com, has done a fantastic job since day one. I mean, hell, they hired Barry Bloom to cover labor. I mean, that was pretty awesome. All right, I want to get down to one of the things we definitely wanted to cover here today, which is the 24/7 news cycle that I don't deal with nearly as much as you guys do, which is one of the reasons I do what I do. I wouldn't want to get. Now, what I'm going to do is, you guys each get 30 seconds to vent. Go. On the 24/7 news cycle, what do you think? Do you like it, or do you like the other way better? Jason, yeah, you're starting.
I always get to start.
Yeah.
It's a very different world than I spent the first 20 years of my career in, but it is the world. And so I just think that the biggest issue with living in a world with Twitter is that it's just so easy to type your 140 characters and hit send without thinking about it, editing it, or reporting it. And that story I kind of alluded to earlier is the biggest worry that all of us have in the media world, is that you tweet something casually and it turns into this raging, out of control, it's not just a mistake, but a crisis. And at ESPN, we have a lot of rules about what we can tweet and how we can tweet and when we can tweet. And whereas other media outlets can just throw it out there. At ESPN, if you're not supposed to tweet news. We're not supposed to report news on Twitter. It has to be run past news editors at ESPN who have to be confident that it was actually reported before you tweet it. And we might get beat on a story by 30 seconds, because of it, but it's worth it because the same, we apply the same standards to Twitter that we apply to reporting any story. And it's a source of nonstop conversation. We have these summits every year before spring training to talk about all kinds of issues in baseball, and we often spend hours just talking about social media and ways to use it and ways not to use it. But in the end, I think it benefits us. Maybe you guys disagree. I don't know.
That was more than 30 seconds.
You got 140 characters now, okay. Paul.
Yeah, I agree with Jason. I think the benefit, especially for the public, is that stuff gets out a lot quicker. You can find out right away. You get the lineups as soon as they're posted, and I think that's good. But I also think that, you know, as Jason pointed out, not every entity is as thorough or as strict about it as ESPN, and a lot of bad information gets out there. So I think it's unfortunately incumbent on the consumer, the reader or whatever, watcher, viewer, listener, to parse things. And that, I'm not sure that's a good thing. I think it brings down the credibility of all of us. But I think probably the benefits outweigh the negatives.
How do you guys, you know, use these media? And I mean, and how does it affect your coverage, perhaps you were initially trained for, okay? Right. You know, we were all trained to write these 850-word, you know, nice, tied-up kind of stuff. Next thing you know, you're working in the 140 characters. How do you handle it?
Well, I don't think, I think the approach is not how to report it first, but in the quality and the perspective you're going to report. I mean, try to make a difference in how do you report it, because like everybody can say, hey, this just happened, and it's different when you try journalistically to present it in a different way, especially in another language for different audiences. In the case that we, like in my case for ESPN Deportes, we gotta think about that our audience, the Spanish speaking audience in the United States and the worldwide audience in Spanish, they might want a different thing. They might want a different perspective. So we kind of like take a time to step back, try to analyze what's the situation, and try to cover the stories the best way, you know, in a different perspective. And it can be in 140 characters. It can be now it's not Twitter anymore. Now it's we have Instagram. Now we have Pinterest. Now we have a bunch of social media and now we have even Google Plus, and they have pages for that, and people getting new followers, and so it might be a picture, it might be words, it might be an article, it might be a video, it might be there's a bunch of ways to report stories right now, and I think the smartest way is just to analyze first before just breaking news and just saying, like, this is what happens. And also, just like Jason was saying, like, in ESPN, we have certain guidelines and certain rules, and we can just go and say, like, hey, I just heard this, and there you go. And so, like, taking a little time to take a step back and think about it and prepare it better, that's the approach.
Don, before we go to you, I just want to ask Leo one thing. To the extent that everything's happening so fast now, how has the English-speaking press, the more conventional press, handled the translating of Latin Americans, presumably Spanish, remarks, okay? Because there has to be editorializing in that. I mean, you're sitting there, it's one thing to write down the words that somebody says, it's quite another to inherently try to decide what did he mean, what word does this translate to? I mean, you could butcher that all over the place, okay?
Yeah.
How has the more conventional American press done in terms of literally translating the quotes that get out there? I mean, when Miguel Cabrera got into all that trouble for, you know, the alcohol the day before the end of the season or whatever it was, you know, probably half of the interviews he did were in Spanish, and then they get translated into English for something that sensitive. How is that handled? Would you say it was handled that kind of thing is handled well, or
I think they handled well. I think we try to handle well because of the people that you have doing that job. Try to work with people who can actually have a cultural background that understand both cultures, understands the Latin culture, understands the American culture per se. So it's kind of a combination of both, and that's why not everybody can actually do it. Mm-hmm. And because you may speak Spanish, but you don't know all the, like you were saying, the meaning of what somebody saying.
Yeah, the idioms.
So it's kind of, and it could get lost in translation. So that's a point where we try to be as accurate as possible. We don't do as much English interviews in the Spanish coverage as we should do, because we try to highlight stories in Spanish. So most of our stories are in Spanish, and we do interviews in Spanish, and try to get more of the players in Spanish because they feel better talking in Spanish. And sometimes we even get like personal or better perspectives from players because they're talking in their native language.
Sure. Don, I don't know about the schedule that you follow, okay, right, or the immediate demands that your your audience has.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about your world?
To your original question, 24/7, I have an expression. There's always another story to write. It really is in this business. And I think the key for us, probably as well as other folks, is to be as accurate as possible. And what you want to make sure is that everything's in place, before you get it out there, before you tweet it. I'm up on Twitter a lot. There's a lot of information, as Jason mentioned, as Paul mentioned, Leo. I mean, there's just a ton of information out there. But you want to be accurate as you possibly can. And what I usually do is, after I run the story by the editor, we get it up on the web as quickly as we can. And then I tweet it. And then I hashtag it and do it, all those kind of things. So the message really gets out there. But I think for us as journalists, I know for me, I try to be as accurate as accuracy is important, and then get you the information that you need. And that's pretty much what we do.
Paul.
Yeah, I just have a story that I think sort of helps illustrate this. We all know Joe Henderson, who was a former sports columnist at the Tampa Tribune. Now he's a Cityside columnist. But several years ago, the Tampa Tribune decided that instead of just being a newspaper, they were going to be a multi-platform purveyor of news, and they entered into an agreement with the local TV station. So one day, the Tampa Bay Rays, the Devil Rays back then, had a press conference, and Joe had to go cover it. And they told him, okay, as soon as the press conference is over, we want you to go right down to the TV studio and talk about what happened in the press conference. So the press conference ends, he goes down, he goes on TV, says, what he thinks he heard and what he thought of it at the time. Then he went home and started making some phone calls and ended up writing a story for the paper that said exactly the opposite of what he said on TV. So I think that's a pretty good illustration of what the immediacy can do to you at times.
Well, isn't that really covering both sides of the story, Paul?
Exactly.
And adding a little bit on the social media, we also have to remember who is the social media audience. I mean, the social media audience is not the same that the newspaper reader. It's not the same that the TV viewer or the radio listener. The reality is that social media, it's a younger audience. So sometimes, I mean, you can throw there like the most interesting and appealing story ever. Like you can say like, hey, I got the proof here. A-Rod tested positive, and he's going to be banned for life, for three lives. So you can say that, and you might get 100 likes. But then you can post a picture of, I don't know, the Philly fanatic hugging Yasiel Puig, and you get 5,000 likes. So it's entertainment too, and the trick is how to be appealing to the audience. If it's a social media, then you gotta know it's a younger audience. If it's TV, then you gotta do a more journalistic type of how to develop stories. If it's a newspaper, it's different. So it's something to remember all the time.
Jason.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about covering the trade deadline, and I mean, we do literally cover it now in real time. And look, it's great if you're a baseball fan to have people like us and many others trying to do play-by-play of trade negotiations. But there's another side to that, and that is it really wears out the people we're covering. That people like us are constantly checking in saying, what's new, what's new, what's new, what's new. They're not big fans of that. And I'll tell you a story. This is at the winter meetings this past year. I got wind of a free agent who was going to meet personally with a team at the winter meetings. And I texted an executive from that team. And he called me right away and he said, all right, here's the deal. You're right. This is going to happen. And he tells me what time is going to happen. He said, but you have to do me a favor. You please do not report this for 8 hours. Because if you throw it out there now, I'll have to deal with it all day. Right? And that's not conducive to me doing my job. But if you don't throw it out there and you call me back in 8 hours, I'll confirm it and I'll tell you where it stands. And you'll be the only one who knows. Now, I've got to make that deal, right? I do. And back in the, when I first started in the business and we lived in a tomorrow morning world and it was all about what was going to be in the newspaper tomorrow morning, that was easy. But when in this world, it means I've got to go through the next 8 hours hoping and praying that nobody I'm competing with hears this, knows this, tweets this, reports this. And that's how it's changed the world for us and the people we cover. It's had a lot of ripple effects that I think sometimes people don't comprehend.
Oh, absolutely. And, I remember, even though I was doing all the football stuff at the time, I've known Don Fear for a very long time. I mean, not as long as you guys, but nonetheless, we have a nice relationship. And I knew somebody at the union who knew that when Don was going to retire, I really wanted to do that story because I also knew Michael Weiner, who was going to succeed him and whatnot. And I got a call at about noon on the day that Don's retirement was going to be announced at 4, maybe, something like that. And I get the call from somebody within the union who's like, hey, by the way, this is going to happen today. And it had not been reported or speculated, or it really kind of came out of the blue. And I appreciated it, because they remembered that I kind of wanted to do that story. And he said, but you can't do it yet. I'm just giving you an early warning so that you're more prepared than you would otherwise be. So I go to my editor, and he says, well, you have to start calling people to confirm it so we can do it now. And I was like, well, no. I mean, the guy only told me to help me get ready for 4 o'clock, not so that we could post it now. I mean, I have relationships with these people. I don't want to screw them. I'm in this for the long haul. And he said, don't report this, but you can be ready for 4 o'clock. And I really had it out with my editor, where I said, I don't want to start calling people so that I can get two people to confirm it, and then we can run it at 2:30, and then the guy who told me about it early goes, WTF. And we deal with real people. And you make deals and you try to be a human being, and yet your editor back home has no idea the type of time and work it takes to develop the relationships that allow you to get 99% of your other information. And I think sacrificing 1% of it, like, I didn't care if I got beat on Don Fear's retirement. So what? You just want to do a good job once it happens. Now, that's one of the reasons I don't cover 24, I don't do tweeting type projects or daily type projects, because I really don't care as a fan if I know it first. I don't want to know if Jake Peavy got traded at 3:32. I can find out on SportsCenter, I don't care. I don't get it. But the relationships you have to build in order to get that information require a lot of deal making. Do they not? I mean, maybe people.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, that's what reporting is. One year at the trading deadline, like the games had started, and so, you know, that's a point where teams are playing, you're not going to be making a lot of calls. And I was home, so I left my office, I went downstairs, I had all my notebooks with me, but I was just kind of watching baseball. My daughter was sitting there, and a guy who's a really good source of mine calls me, and it's kind of late, but his team's game had ended, and he said, "I got a good one for you. There's a three-team deal that's working, blah, 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 blah." And so it turned out to be a really good story. But when I got off the phone, my daughter was sitting there, and she says to me, "Dad, why do people tell you stuff?" And it really got me to thinking. I mean, in some cases, it's because they need things out there, too. But in general, it's because it's about relationships that you spend your whole life and career building, where I trust this guy, he trusts me, he tells me things because he knows he can trust me to handle it and understand it and report it the right way. And I trust him to know that he is telling me the truth. And he's not just giving me something that I can spend the next 4 hours wasting my time chasing. And so building those relationships is what we do. And I don't know, maybe there would be a story at some point in my lifetime that would force me to sacrifice one of those relationships. It's happened, because you have to do your job and you have to tell stories, whether it makes people happy or angry. But in general, building those relationships and maintaining that trust is a really important part of what we do, and that has not changed even in the 24/7 world.
Paul.
I think the statute of limitations has run out, so I can tell this story real quick.
You're a Hall of Famer, baby.
In 1991, the Phillies were 12 games into the season, and there was already some speculation that the manager was in trouble. So in talking to some people before a game in St. Louis, I became convinced that the manager was going to be fired after that game. Spent the game writing the story that the manager would be fired. Phillies lost that day, went downstairs, and the general manager, Lee Thomas, was standing in the middle of the clubhouse. And I went up to him and I said, "Lee, I've just written a story saying that Nick Leyva is going to be fired and that next Tuesday when you play the Mets, you're going to have a new manager. Is there anything you'd like to tell me before I send this story to my office?" And Lee thought about it for a minute and he said, "Yeah, you didn't get it from me."
I want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions, okay? But one thing I wanted to bring up, because it was something that I sort of sensed early on and has completely, you know, gotten out of control, is in 1997, I was the media columnist for Inside Sports, and I wrote about something that was just beginning, how writers, you know, in traditional print media, were having their email addresses printed at the bottom of their stories. This is around 1996, 1997, because the idea was to invite readers to correspond with the writers. And obviously, it was to help cultivate relationships, not only with our sources, but with you guys, our audience. And this is a quote from an anonymous. This was a quote in the story from somebody who wanted to remain anonymous. "Some genius at some meeting decided in his glass office, here's a cute idea, trying to show how smart they are. Once they come up with it, it's up to someone else, us, the writers, to carry it out. It's an extra 3 hours, and we probably won't even get a thank you for it. I don't think this interactivity stuff has gone too far, but I think it can. If a columnist gets 100 emails, and he thinks half of them are idiots, is he allowed to call them idiots? That's not being very user-friendly." Now, I want to see if anyone can be honest here. The person who said that is here on the dais. And I'm wondering who's going to admit it. I feel like we're on What's My Line. Paul, will you please stand
up? My memory's going.
Up?
I don't know. You couldn't possibly be referring to me, could you?
No, it was Paul.
Yeah. Of course.
Paul, that was you. See, Paul was very fond of working for Philadelphia newspapers. It was an No, I mean, it was at a time when really the trading deadline and all this interactive stuff and demands on time, it hadn't taken hold yet, and there were labor negotiations between the writers and the newspapers and pensions getting cut and whatnot, and all of a sudden all this interactivity stuff is thrust on us, And Paul, do you remember feeling that way? And how do you think, here we are 15 years later, 16
in,
years
in
how
retrospect,
did it work
out? In retrospect, I like email a lot better than comment boxes.
Yeah.
It was a burden, but I really did develop a lot of great email relationships with people. And it was, in retrospect, it was interesting sometimes to see the other side. I felt like a lot of times, you know, somebody would call me out on something, and I'd say, well, didn't you realize this guy has a no-trade clause? And then it'd be, oh, I didn't realize that. You know, so there was some of that, but at least you had a chance to respond. And you know, it did take more time. The comment boxes, I think that's gone too far. I hate that. Sorry.
I don't read them anymore. As far as the email goes, I completely forgot what I was about to say. So we'll move on. I get like 1,000 comments on my stories now. And the thing is when you said that the person who wrote in, like, oh, I didn't realize he had a no trade clause. The best one, and I'm sure it's happened to everybody up here, is that, you know, somebody just writes to you, says you're a complete horse's ass. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. It's some bluer language than that, you son of a bitch, blah, blah. Ichiro's the greatest player who ever lived, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you write back. And I, when I was representing myself rather than the Times, you know, I had a little more freedom to really go back at the person, you know, who the hell do you think you are, blah, blah, blah. And then they would, 50 to 80%, you know, in clinical trials, it was shown that 61 to 65% of the time, they would write back and say, oh, I didn't even know you read these. They're like, I didn't know a real person was at the end of this. I thought you were a cyborg or whatever. Yeah. But it was very dispiriting. I think that, you know, we've all heard about, in fact, I want this to be the first thing that we talk about, all of us, and then we'll get to your questions, okay? But when you want to contribute to this, line up. There's a microphone over there. I guess there is not one over there. But I want you guys to contribute to this. It is my belief that we've all talked about how the press has changed, the players have changed, they're more businesslike and more ornery, and the press has changed, they are more, you know, out for blood and focusing on the negative. I believe that as much as those two things have happened, fans have changed more. I think that fans have become nastier. I think they've been focused on the negative as much as the media has tried to satiate them. And now, of course, our audience here is, you know, a bunch of cuddly, you know, baseball fans. But nonetheless, I'm curious what we all think about that, because I think that the appetite of the public has driven a lot of what they then blame the players and the media for. So, you're up.
Well, I'm sorry to not to respond directly to your question, but I really would love to hear from the panel about some news that just broke last night, highly relevant to the panel, namely that my local newspaper, the Boston Globe, has been purchased by John Henry, the owner of the Boston Red Sox. And while we've had major media companies own ball teams before, I think this is the first time that we've had the owner of the local team own the major media outlet in the city. And Alan Schwartz, in particular, I think will also be very interested to hear that his company, the New York Times, which bought the Globe about 20 years ago for about $1 billion.
And sold it for about 28 cents.
$70 million, actually, is what John Henry is going to pay, yes. So I would be very curious to hear what you all think this is going to mean and how much hard-hitting coverage of the Red Sox I can expect to read every morning.
Oh, there will be plenty. From here on in. No, there will be plenty. John Henry's a class act, I believe, at least my dealings with him back, you know, in 04 and whatnot. They're not going to suppress some. I mean, they're, with their market, the minute they suppress some story about, Jesus, I don't know any of the players on the Red Sox anymore. You know, the minute they suppress some story about the manager or about, you know, the new Manny Ramirez, they're sunk. WEEI will go ballistic and people won't read it anymore. If anything, I think you'll see it ratchet up. I really do. Because they're in the, John Henry's not in the business of having to fold the newspaper he just purchased.
Right, but if I covered the Red Sox for the Boston Herald right now, I'd be wondering, is the Globe going to get every story about this team? And Paul, maybe you could speak to this. I know that there are people who work in newspapers who think the MLB.com beat guy gets every story on my team.
Yeah, and clearly that's not true. But I know the guys who covered the Cubs for the Chicago Tribune when the Tribune owned the paper felt like they got less because the Tribune company bent over backwards not to show favoritism to them. So there's that possibility too.
All right, next question.
Hi there, Alan and panelists. You're doing a great job, and no question, you represent the acme of your profession. So now that I gave you a compliment, I'm going to.
Is that like the Wile E. Coyote acme? You know, like the Acme Anvil, the really low-grade Anvil product.
With the potential to attack a sacred cow. You know, this is supposed to be a historical venue. We are old guys. I'm an old guy. I'm a bit of a cynic. And I see baseball, as much as I love it, as much as I remember a ballpark I was at 50 years ago, it's an $8 billion industry. It's an ecosystem. And you, as the media, are very much a part of the ecosystem. So I would like to address the changing, if it is changing, in fact, and get your opinion on the role of the media within the baseball ecosystem. We're all, I don't know, you guys are all probably students of your predecessors. You know who Dick Young is. You know certainly know Cosell, the Chipmunks. You know about the history of the media in sports. But in the old days, a big story that was controversial and got into arguments about how to cover it was, do you write about how many Manhattans Hank Bauer had at the Copa before he took a swing at someone? Okay, the question is, when you get into issues
tough crowd.
Like... thank you. When you get into issues like PEDs, is it your role to step outside of that ecosystem? Because what frustrates me about PEDs is that all the emphasis in the press is on A-Rod and Ryan Braun, and none of it is on Bud Selig, the owners, and the fact that the system itself supports and perpetuates everything that's gone on within this $8 billion ecosystem over the last 50 years.
Okay.
Give me 10 seconds. If you get to an issue like Penn State, you wind up having presidents brought to court.
Will the gentleman from Missouri state question?
No. I think we understand the nature of your question.
How do you
we understand the nature of your question?
How do
Thank
you see
you.
The role of the media in covering these issues?
Right. I mean, it depends on what the it depends on your editor. It depends on your audience. It depends on the staff. Okay, at the New York Times, Michael Schmidt has been the guy who has found out that David Ortiz was on the list. That you know. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we've gotten vilified for it. We've gotten, the Players Association has hated us because it kind of compromises the players, the joint drug agreement. I'm sorry, go ahead. I don't know.
First of all, I don't think the role of the media has changed. I think the degree of difficulty has changed. I would argue with people who say that baseball turned a blind eye to the steroids. I think that what happened, if you look back at it, was there was an attempt made to get drug testing into baseball. The union opposed it. There had been many work stoppages, and at a certain point, a decision had to be made. Are we going to have another work stoppage or lengthen the work stoppage on this issue? Now, we can sit here and argue that they should have, but they didn't. I understand that. I think baseball has done a pretty good job recently, not perfect by any means, but compared to other sports, I think baseball's done a pretty good job. In January, they just announced blood testing for HGH, an unannounced year-round drug testing, which has never been in place before. I think they're trying. I really do. And I think if you look at any other sport, you look at the Olympics, you know, you always hear in the Olympics, well, the chemists are one step ahead of the testers. I'm sure there's some of that going on here, too. But I don't think we can say that baseball doesn't care. I think they are trying to do what they can do.
I want to bring up just one quick point, and then we're going to get to the rest of the questions, and forgive the self-centeredness of this little monologue. But I was a baseball writer for 17, excuse me, sir. I was a baseball writer for 17 years. I loved it. I was in the entertainment business. I didn't think there's anything wrong with that. All of a sudden, then, the football concussion stuff completely lands randomly on my plate. And all of a sudden, my life completely changes. I become this investigative reporter guy for the New York Times working in football where I don't know anybody. And some people have said that the work that I did in football, okay, basically changing the rules and changing the laws across the United States for youth athletes, that happened because I wasn't in football to start with. I had no relationships to strain. I had no connections to exploit. It was just this blank slate. They had no idea who I was or what I could do. And I think it's difficult sometimes. I know it was for me, okay, when Mark McGuire had the bottle of androstenedione up there. I wouldn't have reported it. I wouldn't have, okay? And so it depends who's paying you. It depends what they're paying you to do. And it depends how you're personally involved with the people around you. You, go.
Dixie Taranjo, Boston, Massachusetts. First of all, thank you for coming to speak with us today. This question is for Jason Stark, although I know everybody in here has six questions for everybody. To paraphrase the old quote, I know Peter Gammons. Peter Gammons is a friend of mine, and though you might be this close, you're no Peter Gammons. Could you please comment on Peter's contribution to baseball in the last 45 years?
Wow. Well, a few years ago at the Baseball America Awards banquet, Peter got a Lifetime Achievement Award, and I was honored that he asked me to present it. And I tell Peter this all the time. Peter made my entire life possible. Because everything that I do, everything that all of us do in modern baseball writing and modern baseball media, Peter invented it. He did it first. He did it best. And he was gracious enough to bring all of us with him. And you know, I can't tell you the amount of encouragement that he gave me along the way and how much he helped me on a million different levels and how great it's been to be his friend and co-worker and to have a guy like Peter as my idol. So, I mean, what we do, we wouldn't do quite the same way if Peter Gammons had not been the guy he was and the talented writer and reporter and TV star and journalist that he was and is. Just a great person, and I've never known anybody or admired anybody like him in our business.
All right, next question.
I'd like to add something on Peter. Peter's work, because of his work development with ESPN and the spread of the ESPN networks worldwide, Peter was pretty much the biggest baseball writer name and the reference around the world. So he's been in school outside the United States as well for baseball writers in Europe, in Asia, in Latin America. So his contributions are not only in the United States sport, but worldwide. Thinking also the technology and that pretty much he was in the right place at the right time with ESPN, but at the same time because he deserved it.
And I'll also say that there is no more gracious individual in terms of like a big media star than Peter. As one of the editors at Baseball America throughout the 90s, he not only wrote his column for us basically for free, he made it a part of every contract that he had, whether it was the Globe, ESPN, I don't even remember if he was at the National for 5 minutes or you know.
SI.
You know, or wherever he went, he wrote it into his contract that his stuff could appear in Baseball America because he cared about the draft and he cared about us and he knew how important it was to our survival. And you don't get that often, okay? Next question.
You spoke a lot about the 24/7 news cycle and how, you know, because a lot of reporters have Twitter and things like that, things get broken earlier. But I think also it's interesting to note that a lot of the sources have Twitter as well. I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, of that whole A-Rod story where he said, hey, I'm ready to come back, and Brian Cashman said, mind your own business. Like, that never would have broken if not.
Yeah, that went over well.
Right. Yeah, I know. But I guess my question is, you know, does it seem a lot of times, I mean, especially now that, you know, there are a lot less legitimate media outlets and reporters to sort of handle a lot of this stuff because of the way the media industry has gone, do you find yourself kind of chasing your tail a lot, or find it hard to kind of filter what the real story is when, you know, there is so much more noise out there just from your sources?
Okay, go. Who's going to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take it. There's a lot more work to do. Just like you said, there's more media sites out there, there's more websites, and you have people reporting different things, and you know, you have a person that gets a cell phone, takes a picture of somebody, puts it up on a website, next thing you know, it's a story. So, yeah, you do find yourself chasing a lot of this, not all of it, but a lot of this, and particularly Twitter and Instagram, but also some of the websites that you had mentioned.
All right. I mean, as we've talked about, the tweets can become the story. The tweets take on a life of their own. And, I mean, that's, I think, probably the biggest change, Paul and I have talked about this, the biggest change in our business is the gossipization of mass media. You know what I mean? Just gossip. Gossip is huge. The talk showization of mass media, how everything is framed as a talk show topic. And then just the way social media can frame not just the reporting of a story, but how it can become the story. You know, athletes have the ability to deliver the stories in their words. Sometimes they don't choose those words too well, but they have that ability, and they can communicate with fans directly. They can communicate with people like us directly. I've developed relationships with players all over the country because they'll tweet at me. I'll tweet something that involves them, and they'll tweet back at me. And that part of it is really cool. And so there's just such an incredible breadth of developments that social media has created. And some of them are just nightmarish, but a lot of them are tremendous. And the interactivity of modern media is, for me, I think, on balance, a great thing.
All right, next question.
I've got a question for Don related to the relative lack of black ballplayers compared to a generation ago. First of all, I wonder if in your career you have noticed a decrease in interest in baseball news in the black community. And second, Major League Baseball seems rightly concerned that they're losing a lot of quality young athletes to basketball and football, and that's a problem for baseball. I wonder if you think it's also a problem for the black community that young athletes are choosing other sports, or if that's just a matter of their free choice, and if it's good for them, then that's all that they need.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. I think overall in the black community, basketball and football are really big. I mean, everybody wants to be LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, you know, Jerry Rice, you know, Walter Payton, whoever. I mean, that's really huge. Baseball's still there. I think what it really needs, and I talk to Jimmy Rollins about this a lot, you know, because Jimmy's from the inner city of Oakland, and I have a lot of respect for him and what he's done for baseball. I think what they have to do is get out in the inner city and do like they did like 25, 30 years ago. And if you get a chance, I got an opportunity to do a piece on Irv Davis and Daryl Strawberry. They had a documentary out that ran on BET, and it must be on DVD or on Amazon somewhere. And if you get a chance, check it out, because it showed how they grew up with baseball in Los Angeles, you know, and Crenshaw. And it wasn't anything like, you know, like Major League Baseball now is trying. I mean, here in Philadelphia, we're supposed to get a Major League Baseball Academy, which will be really good. It'll give a real shot in the arm. But they just went to the park, and with them was Barry Larkin and all these other guys. And it was just an older guy that just let them get out there on the field and play. And I think that's what we have to get back to doing. And I think also although we don't have a lot of African Americans playing in terms of statistics, in terms of numbers, there's still a lot of African American stars in this game. Andrew McCutchen is a phenomenal player. I mean, he just is.
Adam
Jones. Absolutely. Okay. Curtis Granderson, Torey Hunter. I mean, all these guys are terrific players. So there's still stars there. It's just that numbers are down. I think there's obviously still interest. I mean, every time I write a story, I usually get an email or a tweet or something, So the interest is still there. I don't think there's any question about that.
I'd like to point out one thing, and I hope it's okay. I see one African-American face in this entire room. And so when people, when Sabres, historians, and thought leaders think about how baseball isn't doing enough to attract the black community, let's look at Sabre, too. Next question.
I have a kind of tangent question for that. So for the Home Run Derby, we saw some of the first broadcast of a bilingual interview, and the Twitter backlash was pretty disgusting on that interview being done in both languages. How do you feel that if there's a future for bilingual sports media, and how do you deal with that negative backlash?
Well, that's an interesting issue because that's something that we do in ESPN every day, every single day. ESPN as a company, like one of the company priorities is to serve more and better the Hispanic speaking audience. Because look at the demographics. I mean, it's not our fault, it's not your fault, it's not anybody's fault, it's the world, it's how the world changes. So we just try to adapt to the audience. So doing bilingual interviews, it's something that it's an everyday. The thing is that this is the first time that a non-English speaker, regardless wherever he's from, won the Home Run Derby and got to be the guy in the center stage. So Yoenny Céspedes is a guy who just came from Cuba last year. In 1 year, you can't speak English enough or well enough to make a national interview. I mean, he can say, like, ham and eggs. eggs, rice, and beans. He can say basic things. He can say, hello, how are you? But he can answer a full question, or he can make a full statement in English. So we're lucky that we have reporters like Pedro, who is bilingual, and Pedro, in that aspect, he just did what we do in the other way every day in ESPN Deportes, which is getting an English interviewee and ask him, hey, what do you think your performance was? Oh, it was great because of this, and that, and I think this, and that. And he would say, yeah, he just said that this, and that. So he did it the other way. And people got criticized. First, I mean, people criticize things anyway. For anything. Like, criticizing is a profession. So, so he got people criticized Pedro for asking the questions in Spanish. What was he supposed to speak? Like, the guy only speaks Spanish. And what were we supposed to do? Put subtitles? I don't know.
So I just want to ask one question. I mean, was that improvised? I mean, had
yes.
they planned?
Well, one of Pedro's great values to ESPN is he is bilingual. He's of Cuban descent, and he has relationships with Spanish-speaking players that other reporters at ESPN don't have, can't have.
Yep.
I'd be curious what you thought. I was stunned that there was that much backlash.
It was embarrassing how much backlash there was.
Look, we did this year, we did during the night of the Super Bowl, ESPN broadcast, ESPN took a telecast of a Caribbean series game that we were producing in Mexico. And so it was, I think it was Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico game. And we took it in Spanish, we did a voiceover in English, and put it on the air on ESPN. So all the graphics and everything was in Spanish.
So we got backlash for that. It was like, why?
Yeah.
Then we got backlash for doing, we didn't, ESPN didn't have rights for World Baseball Classic. MLB Network had it, but ESPN Deportes had it. So what they did was, they said, okay, I'm gonna take a couple games from ESPN Deportes, and I'm gonna put them on our English screen, and we're just gonna let the Spanish go and see how it goes. Got backlash because of that. So it's a business, and it's there's diversity, and that's the way to go, and that's the future.
All right, we got seven people waiting, and I really don't wanna miss any of them, but we have 11 minutes, so you can do the math. Really, 1 minute each, please.
My question is for Donald. The black sports writing establishment has a great tradition of putting pressure on not only major league teams, but also the mainstream press, and critiquing them on issues that are important to African Americans. And I was wondering if you feel that your responsibilities throughout your venerated career have changed at all, or if they're still the same as when you started.
I think basically it's the same, you know, and I'm certainly taking the same approach. I try to bring a lot of things to light, you know. Like, for example, there's a gentleman out here talking about Peter Gammons, and rightly so. I mean, Peter's a tremendous baseball writer. I mean, I've read him for years and years. But, like, my role models have been Sam Lacy and Wendell Smith, and those guys really set the tone back in the day where, you know, racism was rampant in baseball, and you know, we needed representation, and we needed Jackie Robinson in Major League Baseball. Matter of fact, Paul, if you remember, I saw 42, and I came to you, I said, is Wendell Smith in the Hall of Fame? He said, yes. And it was a good thing, because I was going right there, you know. So I try to bring a lot of things to light, you know, in a way where it makes people stop and think. You know, I try not to be overly critical or you know, or to a point where, you know, people are offended, but also when people make people know, give them an understanding of what's really going on out here.
All
so
right. Next question. Thank you. Next question. No, it's okay. I don't want to.
Yeah. Bob Komorowski, Minneapolis.
We got 140 characters. Go!
I'd like to get the panel's comments on Nate Silver's move from the New York Times and 535 blog.
I hate it.
To ESPN.
And I love
it. Nate's our baseball cover.
The guy sucks. No, I mean it. The guy is legitimately a genius. How often do you get to work with guys like that?
Right. I mean, we don't know exactly where this is going to lead, but I agree with Alan. Nate is a genius, and his first love is sports. I can't wait to see what he brings to us that we haven't had before, because I mean, he spent his career kind of reinventing things that we've all done for years, and I'm sure he's going to do that again.
Well, and one thing I would say, though, is I wouldn't overestimate, you know, how much numbers are going to suddenly be flooding out of ESPN. I mean, Nate Silver's a baseball guy who happened to be able to do some wonderful stuff, but he's not a numbers geek. He's a baseball guy who understands numbers first, and I think that's nice for the audience here to know that.
Right. It validates all of us, all of our love for baseball and the numbers of baseball. I mean, Nate's love for those numbers is what created his whole franchise, that you can now apply that thought process to everything. It's great.
And if you want to read about it more, you can purchase The Numbers Game downstairs. Next question.
You explore Alan's assertion that the fans are looking for more negative coverage now. It seems to me that trend has reversed since about 2004, when the owners finally stopped trying to win the labor war by trashing their own players. And the current state of web technology lets some crackpots seemingly dominate the conversation, but if you compare baseball to other aspects of society, it doesn't look like fans are looking for negative coverage to me.
Well, I mean, ESPN is really at the... Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. Oh, I was just going to say that I was always amused when a player or an executive would say to me, well, you guys just want to come up with negative stuff. You want to come up with dirt to sell papers. The reality is that the Philadelphia Daily News, which was pretty much a street sale paper at the time, circulation would go way up on a Monday after the Eagles won and way down on a Monday after they lost. So I don't think that's true.
Well, and I'll tell you an example. When I was at the when I was in the sports department, Carlos Pena, you know, the first slugging first baseman at the time, was with the Tampa Bay Rays and was actually not striking out every two at bats, and he was really good. And I don't know if anyone, you know, you guys know, but he's a very, very intelligent, well-read, thoughtful young man. And when he was coming to town with the Rays, I wanted to do a story where I took him to the Strand bookstore, which is the largest used bookstore in the United States. It's just an unbelievable place to immerse yourself in. And I want to do video and this cool thing about this guy getting to, you know, drown himself in all these books. And the Rays put the kibosh on it. And I told them, I said, every time you complain that the media just focuses on the negative, I want you to remember that decision. Next.
Hi, Mike Bates, Madison, Wisconsin. Could you guys comment on, and this is a little bit of editorializing, the BBWAA's failure to elect any Hall of Fame players this year, despite there being like 10 to 12 viable candidates? Should the BBWA continue to shoulder this responsibility, and how, if at all, would you guys change it? Thanks.
I'm not a member of the BBWA, so.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll take it. I think it's a message. I think it's a message out to the players who are linked to PED in the list, and players that are not linked, like maybe Craig Biggio, are, you know, splashed by that decision. But at the same time, I think that this is not the first time it happens. And I think one of the functions or one of the goals of the Hall of Fame is also to honor history. So I think what they did this year they did a tremendous job in doing this class with like non-living members, but it's an eye-opening warning to players who want to establish a legacy, and I'm not against what they did this year.
If it's okay, I'm sorry. I know that Jason and Paul and Don would have some interesting things to say about that, but there are still three people waiting in 3 minutes, and I really want to try to finish before the hard stop.
Okay, guys, so many subjects, so little time. When you look at ESPN on any given night on SportsCenter, on some of the sportscasts, you see a bunch of bars along the side. Bing, 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 bing. Is there a way or an attempt that could be made to bring A, less negativity, but B, also more conversation into sports coverage? Because between Twitter and all of this, we're just not getting conversation. We're just getting
Have you not
quick
seen
anecdotes.
PTI and Around the Horn and all these talking head things? Isn't there we had too much conversation, in my opinion. I'm not trying to diss you.
We even have a show that focuses on social media trends. Like
SNY in New York has a show called Loudmouths.
Yeah. Like social media trends, right? And on the deadline trade, the opening baseball story was that Chad Qualls fell trying to do a fist pump.
That was awesome.
That was the opening story.
All right. We got, 2.5 minutes?
About 2.5 minutes, so.
Go.
How much truth is there in what I've heard about the Yankees lobbying very hard to get A-Rod suspended for life?
Have you ever had a chance to save $110 million?
I would do the same.
Is it true?
I don't think that Major League Baseball is wild about the idea of Alex Rodriguez being the face of Major League Baseball, you know, from this day forward. So I don't think the Yankees have to twist a lot of arms would be my gut feel on that one.
All right. I'm sorry. Next question.
Last question.
We did it.
Thank you. I was so far back, I wasn't sure if somebody might have already covered this topic, but I wrote a book about the induction ceremony, history of it. The baseball writers attempted to handle this and set guidelines years ago, formed the committee, and the committee was voted down. Everywhere I go, people ask me what's happening, what is going to happen with the players involved in steroids as far as, I know this is not going to be an easy answer quickly. You're not going to answer it quickly, but what are the baseball writers going to do about steroids as far as voting? You have two different groups. Jason, you're in one group, and Bill Madden is in the other group. How are you going to handle your thinking in the future?
It's a fun question to ask when we have 35 seconds left of the program.
I knew that was
but, you know, I've written columns pleading with the Hall of Fame to give us some guidance on this issue. I know that the baseball writers as a group asked the Hall of Fame if they would please give us some guidance on this issue, and they'd rather not. They'd rather just stay out of the way and dump this whole mess into our laps, and I thank them very much. It's been very enjoyable.
Okay.
Alan, your closing comment?
Well, I mean, just I want to thank these guys. You have no idea how hard they work. You know, particularly around this time of year, Jason Stark, Paul, Leo, Don, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.